Hello, OT friends, and welcome to the Uncommon OT series. I'm Patricia Modis, and I'm your host, a Filipina-American, native New Yorker, currently based in Los Angeles, bulldog mama, and an uncommon occupational therapist myself for the past 22 years. On this podcast, you will hear me proudly feature the unique careers of occupational therapy practitioners working in non-traditional and rural emerging practice areas, settings where OT is uncommon. I invite you to receive a dose of OT inspiration to learn, to think outside of the box, and to be energized and motivated to follow in these unconventional paths. Happy listening. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to highlight and extend a special thanks to TrueLearn and Picmonic, our sponsors. Picmonic is a visual mnemonic learning tool that's been research proven to increase retention and help students ace their exams. It uses audio-visual learning and intelligence-based repetition algorithms that really help with long-term retention while studying. It is an excellent learning resource and study aid for OT and OTA students. Picmonic has built a better way for students to prepare for tests, whether you're studying for classes or getting ready for the NVCOT exam. Try it for yourself and sign up today using the link in the show notes and using the code TRANSITIONSOT to score a discount of 20% off of your Picmonic membership. Happy studying! Hello, OT friends, and welcome back to the Uncommon OT series. I'm Patricia Modis, and I'm your host. So today, I am super delighted to introduce you to our guest of honor, Francis G. Francis is a dear friend, a mentor, and an uncommon occupational therapist who works in mental health academia. Francis is an occupational therapist who earned her Master's of Science degree in Occupational Therapy from San Jose State University, as well as her Bachelor of Arts degree in Psychology. She has approximately 20 years of practice in mental health OT and more than 10 years of practice in long-term acute care. Francis has work experience in skilled nursing, short-term acute care, and child-adolescent mental health. Mental health OT is Francis's first love of practice. From 2013 to 2016, Francis has served as an adjunct faculty member of the OTA program at Stanbridge University. And in January of 2017, Francis left clinical practice to join the full-time faculty at Stanbridge. She has taught a wide variety of courses, and at present, her focus includes mental health OT, documentation, and terminology. As of fall 2021, Francis has been serving as a thesis advisor for the MSOT program at Stanbridge. In her life outside of work, she enjoys live music performances, plays, and movies, plus some occasional traveling. And she's also a wine enthusiast, something she and I have in common. So without further ado, to talk to us a little bit more about her OT work in mental health and academia, I'd like to present to you Francis G. Welcome, Francis.
Hi, Patricia. So good to be here, and thank you for inviting me. It's an honor.
Oh, thank you for spending the time with us. I look forward to speaking more about your uncommon OT work. As I mentioned in our intro, you know, you have been a mentor to me and in my work in academia. And, you know, I really appreciated all the support that you provided me. And I just valued everything that I've learned during that time. And, you know, I'm just so looking forward for our listeners to hear your expertise, to hear about your work and what brought you to this type of work and, you know, literally how you got there, right? To inspire others.
All right. What would you like to know first? Because I can just talk away and it'll be like a mile a minute. Or if you had a specific question. I mean, I could start at the very, why don't I start at the very beginning, Patricia? I didn't know what occupational therapy was, never heard of it. And I was undergraduate student at San Jose State University. I started in the fall of 1978. It took me, I planned for it. It took 4.5 years to earn my bachelor's degree because it was realistic. I didn't want to be rushing through it. I wanted to take my time and do it right. So after I earned my bachelor's degree in the fall of, let me think, 1982, I took about a year and a half off. Took some time off because I'd entertained the thought of entering medical school. I made a couple of applications that didn't get me admitted past the first round. I wasn't too heartbroken because deep down, I knew that was not for me, but I didn't want to have any regrets, right? So I was just going, okay, what's my next move? Well, I had some really good friends in the dormitory where I was a resident. Same room, I set a world record. Same room for the 4.5 years I was there. I had a variety of roommates, and people said to me, they were studying OT for their bachelor's. They said, Francis, have you ever thought about a career in psychiatric occupational therapy? And I was intrigued. I thought, what is that? So I asked them, and the more they told me, the more intrigued I got. And what sold me, Patricia, was they said, it combines, this field combines every skill that you have, every leisure interest that you have, every personal interest that you have, and everything that you like to do. All right. And I remember the word do. So I thought you sold me. So I applied, made it through the very arduous admissions process. You know, I was one of 20 students who were admitted over a field of 200 plus applicants. So in I went, 1984, somewhere around there. So it took 2 academic years of courses. The first year we took our core OT courses with the undergrads. So we were sharing space and time with the undergrads, even though we graduate students kind of stuck together, right? And then we moved on to the graduate level courses, things like research methodology, independent learning, a lot of courses dealing with OT theory. And I remember first learning about Gary Kielhofner's model of human occupation, all those things. And we had professors in our faculty who are well-known theorists. And our director for many years, the great, the legend, the goddess, Lilla Lawrence, who developed theory. So she studied every master's thesis that went under her nose, even though she was not necessarily everybody's thesis advisor.
Francis, can you describe to us a little bit about your uncommon OT work and, who you serve?
Yeah, the population we serve are OTA students. In the very beginning of their curriculum, we have 6 terms, right, to just about the very end. And I'm involved in the first term, the third term, and the fifth term. It depends on the courses I'm assigned to teach. And the ones that are pretty much mine to teach, if you will, are mental health basics. Formerly, we called it the psychology course, but that was a misnomer because psychology lent the impression that you study everything psychology. Far from the point. We only taught the concepts of psychology and mental health that addressed occupational therapy, that occupational therapy as a profession would want to know about and incorporate into the practice, right? So we learned about the developmental theories, learned about the different diagnoses, learned about the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, fifth edition, of those things, the core things that they'd need to know if they were going to be proficient in working in a mental health setting or
Got it.
in a non-mental health setting with physically disabled patients, because people are complex. They have a variety of issues. That's part of the typical. And also with the documentation course. Also with the documentation course, and it's been exciting because here's a little trade secret. I document really well. I write really well. And that's why I inherited that course. So, what we do is we teach the anatomy of writing a SOAP note, right? That's a standard form for a progress note that clinicians write. Then there are special types of notes, treatment notes, incidental notes. But we teach them to write in a way where it's respected, things are communicated about the status of the patient, things are communicated about, well, what if they're not responding to treatment? It's just documenting progress or lack thereof. So that's documentation.
That is so important
Oh,
for
you know,
future therapists to
yeah,
know.
And I have to impress on the students, because it was pounded into my awareness when I was a young clinician, that if you didn't write it, you didn't do it. And I could refine that as, if you didn't write it correctly, you didn't do it, right? So they have to be really careful with the terminology they use. And yes, I taught terminology, so that was a plus in teaching documentation. And it's been a really neat experience to see them grow and learn how to write in a professional way, to cut out the slang. And one of it's like a pet peeve. One of the concerns I have is that in this world of texting, right, you know, we all do it, right? Some of us do it more than others. My concern is that some students will not drop that texting habit when it comes time to document
properly. Oh boy.
Right. Well, I could talk about that issue, Patricia, all day long.
Well, we only have a 45-minute episode.
So I show them there's recognized abbreviations, and then you have to leave out of the equation your personal ones. I've also taught foundations, and that's the course you mentioned to me before we settled on this recording time. And, you know, some people think, clinicians think they're not qualified to teach it, but it actually is a pleasure to teach. I'm glad I'm not teaching it all the time, because I know some of my teaching partners, they do a much better job than I do, I feel. But the neat thing about that course is you acknowledge your roots in detail. You acknowledge your roots in World War I, reconstructive, you know, era, working with, you know, shell-shocked, you know, war vets, that sort of thing. And that's a neat thing to teach. So, because we want to know where we came from, so that it informs us about where we are now and where we would like to go in the future. Right.
Yes.
So those are about the courses I teach. Psychosocial, it's an extension of mental health basics, because it teaches them how to lead a conductive activity, conduct a successful activity group, right? Those things, how to address different symptoms, how to put forth your best therapeutic sense of self, how to put together a treatment plan, all of those nuts and bolts things that are really vital to mental health.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And thanks for sharing with us, you know, more details about your teachings and the focus of your teachings. Can you share with us now what inspired you to teach? What inspired you to do this type of work?
That's an easy one, Patricia. I used to work in a national chain of long-term acute care hospitals, and one of the locations was in Brea. And I worked with a really talented group of nurses and nurses aides. And one nurses aide in particular, we'd chat, right? And she'd be overhearing my lessons, teaching skills, exercises, energy conservation, and all that with our patients. She said, "Frances, I love hearing you talk." I go, "Pardon? What do you mean by that?" And I'm really flattered. "Thank you." And she said, "You know, I love the way that you communicate to patients what you're teaching them to do. You communicate so clearly." And her next question sent my senses reeling. She said, "Have you considered, you know, recording books on tape?" I go, "Well, thank you for that compliment." And I checked it out briefly, but I didn't follow through with it, obviously. But the next natural place for me to use those communication skills was teaching, right?
Ah.
So there was a vacancy for a part-time instructor position at Santa Ana College many, many years ago. I applied for it. I had a pretty decent interview. At the same time, I was frightened to death, because I thought, teaching a lab class, what is that going to be like? Developing the curriculum, what is that going to be like? What are those challenges like? But it turned out that I didn't have to worry, because they couldn't hire someone. They liked me, but they couldn't hire anybody because, get this, and you're going to be like floored. They couldn't hire anybody at the time because the enrollment wasn't high enough. There wasn't a, in other words, there
sounds familiar.
Yeah. There wasn't a demand of students that necessitated hiring more faculty. So I thought, okay, I like the medical school experience. I thought, okay, I had this pleasant experience. I met that challenge. I felt confident. Let's see what else comes up in my career. So then comes the recruitment letter from Stanbridge. At the time, it was known as Stanbridge College, right? In the early 2010s. Satch sent out some recruitment ads. I interviewed for a teaching position maybe I was interested in the assistant program director. That position got filled very quickly. And then he called me out of the blue going, well, we have a position. And Tina called me too, the assistant program director, saying, would you be interested in teaching such and such a course? It begins such and such a time. And I thought, oh my God, it's happening, right? So what I ended up doing was teach part-time. In other words, it was very intensive to working with a group of full-time, usually part-time cohorts. And it lasted 6 to 8 weeks maybe, but it was intense because it would meet two evenings a week, either Monday, Wednesday, or Tuesday, Thursday, and then on a Saturday, right? Most Saturdays, not every Saturday. And I juggled working my day job with working in teaching. So it was a juggle, you know.
Can you describe to me how you got there? How did you get to this path of teaching?
I got it because, you know, I was interested, you know, in I was inspired by people I worked with who told me that I had the potential to teach, right? So that's what happened. One attempt didn't materialize, and that's okay. I gave it a go, and I figured it wasn't time. But another opportunity came up, and I was told by our program director, Satch Purcell, that this was the time. Because in the ensuing time, I developed enough clinical experience, which is very important, clinical experience that would help check boxes. In other words, I had the experience working with people with different diagnoses that included mental illness. So I could teach other subjects besides mental health, right?
Yes.
So I got started teaching physical disabilities, ironically. And I did okay at it, but really my forte is teaching mental health because I knew it so well. And it's always been a passion of mine. It's always been a passion of mine for personal reasons. So, you know, that's what got me going. And I've enjoyed those courses the most, the absolute most.
So you're basically saying that it's important to have a certain amount of sort of clinical experience before going into academia.
Absolutely, because otherwise you don't have as in-depth a basis to teach. You know, it's the experience of sharing, well, this is what the patient is about. It's not just about having high blood pressure, as important as it is, or the COPD or the whatever it is. It's how motivated are they to address those issues? How compliant will they be with protocols? And a lot of those issues relate directly to mental health. You know, how do you feel about it? Are you admitting that you have these problems? Because a number of people were in denial. Right?
Yes.
How do you address denial? How do you address poor motivation to participate? How do you, address people who've been, you know, grieving, you know, various losses in their lives and they've lost the will to continue or to live, right?
Yes.
So they have these medical problems and we dealt with everything at once, all right? Although we were hired to deal with the medical, we had to address the mental. That was logical too.
Got it. So thanks for, you know, sharing with us more details about, and you know, going back to sort of like a typical day for you,
okay,
right? Or maybe even a typical week, right? Like I guess I just want our listeners to have an idea of, you know, how much time do you spend teaching? How much time do you spend preparing for your classes? What is it like being an OT in academia?
Let me give you the current scenario because it's more relevant than previously. Our courses, the theory courses meet 3 hours, let me think, 3 hours a day, usually once a week. But the documentation course meets twice a week. Every course is set up slightly differently depending on how intense it is and how long it is. But generally, theory course is 3 hours a day. We full-time instructors have to carry a load of at least three different courses, right? Whether they're lab, whether they're theory. Mine are pretty much theory these days because I can't really teach a lab anymore because of my medical issues, so physical issues. So I teach theory courses. And when those class times are up, you do keep office hours. And, you know, in the course syllabi, they talk about, well, this instructor has office hours from this time to this time. But basically, you're in office hours whenever you're not in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Right? And that time is spent grading. That time is spent emailing students. That time is spent processing remediation. In other words, makeup work for the time that they missed. Mm-hmm. Occasionally you spend time tutoring students.
Okay.
Because they are unable to meet with a student peer tutor, or their needs are not being met by all the resources we have on campus, as good as they are. And sometimes I will meet with a student that way. And there's a lot of other things. You know, the thesis advisor gig that I'm having mm-hmm. students once a week, and you kind of monitor where they're at in their research project, right? You don't do it for them. Yes. But you're there as a resource and a sounding board, and they really appreciate your years of practice and, mm-hmm. and your knowledge, right? And your experience. So that is a real pleasure. And you do grade things out of their various research courses, but eventually you act as like a mentor, and they look to you, what's the next step? Are we doing this right? How does our, you know, application for human subjects approval work, et cetera, you know,
yes.
right, in research. So that I've come to really, really enjoy. So that can take all, you know, a 40-hour week, but oftentimes, depending on how many classes you teach and how much grading you have to catch up on, you're spending a lot more time than 40 hours a week. I'll be very honest. Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for your honesty about that, or your transparency about that. I think it's just important for our listeners to know what it's actually like. And you've been doing this for a little while now, right?
Yeah.
So
you know,
not something that's new to you.
No. And I've been doing it for like 7.5 years now.
Yeah.
As a full-time.
And there's so many different aspects to your job too. And as you were sort of listing them, I was thinking about like the OT skills that, you know, would really come into play, right? The OT skills that...
Oh, you have to have them. The cognitive skills, Patricia, prioritizing, managing your time. And may I include managing your time in the classroom teaching a course?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to balance the lecture time with a little bit of time to work on an exercise, but you have to do a lot of teaching. And that balance is so delicate, all right? And the more experience you gain, the better off you are. The more classes you've taught, the better off you are, right? And you're dealing with people also who occasionally you have students who need special accommodations, ADA mm-hmm. accommodations.
Support,
so we have to address that. So we have to support them. And the tutoring and all of that. Meetings, staff meetings, in services, going to conferences. In the early years, I'd represent Stanbridge at OTAC. Mm-hmm. Never at AOTA, but at OTAC to run the information booth at Stanbridge, things like that. But lately, I haven't had to do that. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thanks for, you know, highlighting some of those OT skills that have really come into play for you. One thing that kind of stuck out for me was just in terms of you working with students, right? And understanding their needs even. Right?
Yeah.
Realizing, you know, okay, they might need a little bit more support than they're seeking or, you know, recognizing, right?
Right.
But we're seeing based on performance that that's actually the case.
Yeah. And their needs are so different, Patricia. And some of it depends on their chronological age. Now, everyone in every profession, every career endeavor has acknowledged there's the Generation X. There's the generation that came before, but they all have different needs, different learning styles, you know.
Yes.
And we had to pay attention to that because that helped us determine how we were going to teach.
Yeah. So that might be a good segue to the next question. Like, how do you stay on top of the learning? How do you continue to learn in order to do the work that you're doing?
That's an easy answer. And the easiest is something that Stanbridge has had in place. And I think it's the most convenient thing. They have a professional relationship with the Center for Excellence in Education, CEE for short. And it's totally free to all faculty and staff. It's really the faculty. They encourage you to take like online courses that get you a certification that states, and you've taken the exams, you've gone through the online courses, that certifies that you're a qualified online learning professional. Mm-hmm. All right. Pandemic or pre-pandemic or during pandemic or present conditions, right? Because you're a lot of things you're doing online or things you're doing on a grounded classroom, and they cover those issues, right?
Yes.
Managing your classroom time, keeping people engaged, that is an absolutely huge topic. And during mm-hmm. the pandemic, we needed to know how to do that because it's like we don't have those cues that we have in a grounded classroom. You're relying yes. on other things. Really, really challenging stuff. And it was really neat a couple of seasons ago to be recognized as somebody. I was one of three of our teammates in the same department. We excelled at engaging students because they had to fill out like occasional reviews, questionnaires.
Oh, fantastic.
Which instructors did you find engaging? And it was nice to be picked as not picked or, you know, that they saw me as being pretty engaging. And that was a real honor. If so, anyway, CEE, that's one of the ways to kind of like enhance your professional development.
Yes.
Another one, and this is very obvious, and I'll say this to anybody, whether you're an uncommon OT or not, it really behooves you to attend as many conferences as possible, right? It's been impossible for me, to be honest, to attend AOTA with it, you know, the World Congress, yes. but go to what you can, even if it's regional Occupational Therapy Association of California, because you network with people, you meet with people, you learn things in workshops, and it's fascinating stuff. And then you get the continuing education unit. So that's mm-hmm. another way to go, right?
Yes.
Still another way, and this is something I haven't done as often, is webinars, whether you purchase them from AOTA or another source, right? You take courses and you get CE credit that you keep records of to help you maintain your license, right?
Yes.
And then comes, which is the low priority, but for me, because of my interest in mental health, I would invest my own time, my own money, my own resources to take psychology courses. Because when we're studying mental health, one of the big topics that we study and teach on is cognitive behavioral theory, right? Mm-hmm. And that's used in just about every profession, every career endeavor. But I'd like to know like the roots of cognitive behavioral therapy, about famous cognitive theorists, right? So that would involve going to psychotherapy conferences. And I've done a couple of online versions of that where unfortunately, AOTA is not a sanctioned approval to that. So you can't get credits for AOTA, but I would do it just for the sake of the learning. And it was important enough to me. And it's a tax write-off anyway, because it's a professional expense. So I did it anyway, right? So it's helpful if you had limited resources to go with the workshops to maintain your license, to maintain your national certification, and then the rest of it is gravy. If you have a particular interest that's not served by an OT conference per se, look at the related ones. You may not get CEUs for your license, but good God, the material is just so rich.
The knowledge is
rich. And our own program director has supported me in that. He says, do it. I think that's a great thing that you're doing it. And I've never regretted it. I've done it twice with a Congress called the Evolution of Psychotherapy. It's great.
Oh, excellent. Well, thanks for sharing that. Maybe we can even add that to some of our show notes and share it with some of our listeners. But, you know, I don't want to forget, but to congratulate you on your, on being recognized, right? For being a motivational instructor. I, you know, got a taste of that during my Zoom adjunct instructor days, and you know, really was quite a challenge.
It was, but I remember that session I sat in on where you had that really talented mental health OT who had his own struggle with bipolar disorder, right? I still have his books to this day that I ordered. My apologies, I have yet to read them, but they're there for me to read when I get the opportunity. I thought you handled that session beautifully, right? And it helps that instructors like you, whether you're currently instructing or not, the networking is so priceless. I feel like I'm weak in the networking department, but I underestimate what I know and who I know anyway, right?
Yes.
But everybody, if you take a look in your own backyard, so to speak, you're going to know one or two people who would be great guest speakers in your class, who you could lean on for development of a side hustle if you wanted to experiment with a different part of OT practice. Mm-hmm. And then talk about inspiration. Years ago, I worked with a patient whose daughter was his caregiver, and she had retired early from the airlines as a flight attendant. Well, one thing led to another. Long story short, I said to her, "You're a great caregiver. Have you considered a career in occupational therapy?" And there she went. She went to OTA school at Santa Ana College, became a really good qualified OT assistant. We saw Fantastic. Each other at a conference, and she was crying when she saw me, going, "Because of you, you've inspired me to enter the field." And that meant the world to me.
Oh, that's incredible. Mm-hmm. I guess that's another good segue to our next question, okay. Just in terms of career advice. You know, our some of our listeners might really be interested in going into academia. I know in my latest conversations with OTs out there, a few have expressed to me sort of this desire to do that, but just, you know, they find that it's a difficult area to penetrate.
Yeah, it's difficult. It depends on the era, you know, what the circumstances were, the culture was at the time you developed this interest, right? At the time I developed the interest, there were opportunities, right? There were, may I mention, and this is a very important point, at the time that I started to get involved, there were far fewer academic institutions that offered OTA programs, MSOT programs. Now, where there's so much competition out there. I want to make that really, really clear, because that's going to influence where you get hired and what you're expected to do. Yeah. And, you know, because of the competition, that's going to affect enrollment at a given institution or an entity. Mm-hmm. And if enrollment is very slight, the institution can't afford to hire a lot of instructors. So full-time versus adjunct. So that's going to influence how easy it is for you to latch on somewhere. But my yes. advice for anybody considering entering the field is put your hat in the ring, submit a resume to a variety of academic institutions, you know, highlight your clinical experience, highlight the types of diagnoses of patients that you've been working with, highlight the practice setting, and represent yourself well, advocate, and it just might catch the eye of somebody who's looking for somebody like you, and you don't realize it, right? Yeah, just throw it's kind of like going fishing. You know, throw your rod out there.
And yes, and is it safe to say that typically one would start out as adjunct?
Yeah. I highly recommend, Patricia, adjunct is the way to go. Very rare. I frankly don't know if I would have succeeded. I made plenty of gnarly, horrible mistakes as a beginner. We all go through that learning curve. But as an adjunct, you know, it's not like you're in it all the time. Presumably, you're still working in your day job. And the cool thing is you have the day job experiences that help you become a better instructor, right?
Yes.
And being a better instructor helps you be more aware of the things that you do in a typical workday. Yes. And that way you're in a better position to teach. So each helps the other. But again, I'd encourage people to just get your resume out there. Check out what schools there are in the area, even ones that are not in the area, because I know one person, our former site manager at where you used to teach, where you've been teaching. And when she'd moved on to other opportunities, she developed a relationship with a university that was based back east. And a lot of this learning was remote learning. So she was given the freedom to develop a course for upperclassmen that dealt with program review and other things. And I thought, that's pretty cool. So, you know, if you're the type who thrives on online learning, try it. If you don't thrive on it, try it anyway, get your feet wet, right? Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't suggest that you just drop your full-time career altogether and start teaching, because it is a huge learning curve.
Yes.
Huge learning
curve. And thanks for that advice. It totally resonates with me. I loved being able to teach a class and you know, do my clinical work on the other days too. Yeah. I liked having that variety.
Yeah.
yeah, I just found it. Both work complemented each other, right?
Yeah, I'd say that to our program director all the time. I go, yeah, it made for long days, two nights a week, and you give up a bunch of Saturdays. But you know what? It's just very fulfilling because each relieves you from the monotony and the burnout of the other.
Yes.
And he felt the same way because he's also, our program director is also a licensed acupuncturist. So he'd do his acupuncture treatments on weekends. He'd do his program director duties all week, and each gave him refreshment from the other. Incredible. So that you didn't mind a long night. And incidentally, with the commute, may I say that when you're teaching evening course, it's not too bad because you're coming down when everybody else is coming back up in the other direction. Mm-hmm.
Right? We're talking about LA traffic, people.
Thank you. LA, sister, LA and Orange County in particular. And when you're done at about 10 o'clock at night. It took, I kid you not, about 20 minutes to get home. So I'd be going to bed at 11 roughly. So it's not like I had to rush to go to bed. I could unwind a little bit. It was, and unfortunately, I lived closer because Irvine campus, where I live in Anaheim, reasonable drive. I was very fortunate. Yeah.
Oh, but yes, nice to have the sort of diversity in your week, right? Or in your schedule, and even just the groups of people that you're working with. Because working with students versus working with patients, and it's sometimes really refreshing, at least for me, just to be in an entirely under a different roof or just working with a whole nother different group of people.
There you go, because there's variety. You know that saying, that adage, variety is the spice of life. It's just so true. When you balance academic life with clinical life, it's great.
Yes.
Yeah.
So can we now segue into money matters? Because that also is an important question for a lot of our listeners, right?
Sure.
Those who are interested in going into teaching, what can we expect? How do we expect to be paid? I know adjunct versus full-time faculty are very different. So maybe you can just share with us a little bit about what you know.
Sure. I know as an adjunct faculty member, this is the downside. As an adjunct, you're paid for the hours of your course. If it runs from 6 to 10 on a weekday evening, twice a week, there's 6 to 10, that's 8 hours for you. And then if it runs 6 hours, and this was the old school, things are different now. And we don't have part-time cohorts anymore, but just for the sake of discussion, you basically get paid for the hours that your course runs.
Yes.
Right?
Not hour, necessarily for the extra time.
That there you go.
Putting into the.
Yeah. And that's the major
planning of the course.
Major, major disadvantage. That's why you have to really love it in order to give up free time to do it. And it's going to take away from whatever salary you earn, stipend you earn. And that's just a part of being part-time. Whereas with a full-time, and here's a confession I have for you. All my life, in every OT position I've ever worked at, I've been paid an hourly wage. So the first time in my life ever, all right, I became a salaried employee as a full-timer. What was that like? So there are some interesting rules, okay? And you get paid for the year. They give you roughly the same amount every pay period. You know, withdrawals for benefits are the same. I don't mind, you know, breaking it down in that sense for you, because I'm sure your audience would want to know.
Yeah.
So that part's the same, but you have to remember sometimes, like some weekends, there's a crunch in time. You're trying to finalize course grades. The pressure is on. You need to put in that time, period.
Yeah.
I remember, depending on the course, depending on how heavy a course load that I would carry, that I'd have to work every weekend for the better part of a day both times, you know, when it got really bad, right? And I'll be very candid. Or during the week, you're working a lot more than 8 hours in a day. The longest I've worked in a day was maybe 11 hours. Right. Mm. Of course, I take my frequent breaks, you know, and that's to be expected. But there are some days that the cool thing is there are some days when you've done everything you need to do and you're not at it for 8 hours. So that's the plus. And what's the adage? As long as your work gets done. Right. Yeah, I think that saying, Patricia, is what dictates how much time you put into it. Either sometimes you put in less because it gets done sooner, or you're putting in one bodacious amount more because mm-hmm. you need to put it in to find license grades. In academic settings, because we're a private setting and because the majority of our students have financial aid, the dropping, meaning there's a slang phrase, meaning the delivery, the movement, right? Mm-hmm. Of their financial aid funds is dependent on course grades from a previous term closing out by a certain deadline. And I'll be the first to say sometimes that, or often, that deadline is very tight.
Yeah,
I understand why it happens. I can live with it. I'm not going to complain that much, but sometimes it's just unreasonable, the mm-hmm. pressure, right? But you do what you can and you try to be proactive. This is where, yeah, you know, you were picking my brain earlier about OT skills that we need to be OTs, right? Mm-hmm. Time management is so incredibly yes. important, right? You can imagine now that comes into play big time. Prioritizing, knowing what mm-hmm. comes first, working on the most pressing course before you move on to regular grading for another course you'll still have for a couple of weeks.
Yes, because you're juggling three courses there we go. At the same time, right?
At least three. And when there's a shortage, and we've come through this season where a couple of teaching partners were on medical leave for various reasons, or we lost one because she transferred to the master's program, the administration, you know, that leaves us really short. And then yes. coupled with low enrollment, you know, administration can't quickly, or it's a policy, they can't just bring back a lot of adjunctive faculty.
Yes.
We full-time faculty pretty much have to carry it.
Well, thanks for yeah. sharing with us, you know, sort of schedule-wise, what it looks like. And it sounds like there's some pretty long days, but it also sounds like there's some days that are more manageable than others, right?
Yeah.
Just like any typical kind of setting. What about myths or any types of misconceptions that you'd like to share with us about your role?
Oh my goodness. That's a really, really, really good question. Let me say this about being an educator and academician. Even my mentor had a hard time saying that. But academician, it's not easy.
It's not
a piece of cake. It's not a walk in the park. All right. It takes a lot of energy and sweat and frustration. You do what you can for students, but it's unfortunate when you have a variety of students who get dismissed. Once in a great long while, you have a student who's committing academic dishonesty, i.e. cheating, you know, dishonesty of any kind. Through COVID, talk about challenges of its own. You, as an educator, when you're working remotely, it can be a horribly isolating feeling. What I miss the most, and I've talked about it with Satch, was just the day-to-day sitting in the office shooting ideas around. If yeah. I needed to get quick feedback on something, I'd say, Satch, you got a minute? Or so-and-so, have you got a minute? And we just talk right out there. But here, working remotely, it was not as easy. So things have been better in that we've basically been back on campus. But for some of our courses, because of our program director's discretion, and I totally support it, the courses like the one I teach, one of the ones I teach, Mental Health Basics, it's permanently online because it's more convenient to conduct it that way.
Yes.
Right. Some of the gen ed courses, they're done that way. But certainly anatomy and physiology with the labs, you must meet on campus. That way you can access the virtual reality lab, the anatomage table, all of those things, right?
Yes.
Cadavers, the syndavers. So yeah, that's the myth that I want to debunk right away. You can't just walk into it and go boom, boom, boom. And for me, I enjoy it better than clinical practice. I do miss it, but on the other hand, as a middle-aged adult who's got health issues, right, health challenges, it suits me,
yeah.
All right? It suits me because it doesn't wear my body out, right? But the disadvantages is it can be horribly isolating when you're working at home.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
Can you share with us any recent successes that you've had in your role?
If I may, the newest one, and I had no idea that it would be, well, I had some idea, but no idea it would be this rewarding as a thesis advisor. Last fall, we had an assistant program director in the MSOT program who left her position to move on to, you know, other things because she felt moved to try something new. And before she left, she approached me one day and said, Frances, have you considered becoming a thesis advisor? I go, what? You know, and because there was a shortage for various reasons, they needed a total of 16 people. It's not true that you need to have a clinical doctorate, because I want to make it clear, I do not have a clinical doctorate. I have a master's degree. But as long as you have a master's degree and even a bachelor's degree, you're good to go. But really, a master's degree is ideal. So I said, I thought all of like maybe like 10 seconds. And I said, yeah, I'd be happy to do it. And one colleague was just thrilled that I was doing it because she and I had many long talks. She said, you know, you have a fondness for research still, right? I go, yeah, absolutely. So that's another thing. I don't get paid
that's
extra.
Exciting.
For it. Yeah. I don't get paid extra for it because I'm a full-time salaried employee. I don't get a stipend. Now, if I had no connection with Stanbridge and I were a clinician from the community, I would be, I would have to apply and I would be paid a stipend, right?
Got it.
But as it is, you're not. But that's just something out of my own desire to grow professionally. I do it. And again, it's yet another way to pay for it because I was once a graduate student. So it's been a thrill and a half. I work with four very talented individuals. Each has their own strengths and weaknesses. And just yesterday, they made their presentation of their research proposal. And it went well, right? And before I had to leave to go teach at Alhambra, they said to me, thank you for everything. Not that this was the end of the road. This was just the end of one phase, right?
Yes.
But for them to thank me and to look up to me and value what I had to offer, it meant the world to me.
Yes.
So I'm looking forward to the rest of the journey because here you're kind of moderating the steps they take in doing their research, writing the report, presenting it. I know towards the end of the year, they have like a showcase where it's like poster presentations all throughout the Irvine campus. Wine and cheese, you know, invite the family members, people get dressed up, you know, and it's kind of nice. And I've been to one of those as a spectator, but never one as a thesis advisor. So it's the closest I'll ever come to having my own children graduate from something, right? I don't have children. So, you know, I don't know what's that like, but that's like, but that this is going to come awfully close.
Wow. Well, Frances, you offer so much value to everyone that you touch. Me personally, you know, having experienced you as a mentor in my role as adjunct instructor, was instrumental. I've observed and you know, seen you interact with our Stanbridge students, and you're incredible. And I've, you know, seen the students really respond so positively to your approaches. So I love that you're doing what you're doing and that you continue to feel passionate about what you're doing. And not only that, but you're also kind of, you know, finding these other parts of your work that's continuing to sort of stimulate you and motivate you to kind of keep moving forward and doing that. So I just want to say congratulations on
Thank
all
you.
Of that.
Many thanks. People like you, if I may give you kudos in return, when you have somebody who's so willing, who has that passion, and your background is extraordinary, to have come from mental health, to be a registered yoga instructor, and now to do these broadcasts, I tell my students to follow you on Instagram.
Yay!
I tell them, give her a listen, because you never know if one of you is going to end up doing this. All right. People need to know and talk about an ideal vehicle for self-advocacy for our profession. Not enough people know what we do.
Yes.
Not enough.
Yes.
So,
and particularly the uncommon OT things that we do, right? So we're always educating about OT, but now there's also this other level, which is now educating even other OTs about the more non-traditional settings and areas that we can really be offering our service.
Yeah, I'm all in support of that, because with all due respect to the traditional, they're the ways where we get started. They're the ways where we get the necessary prerequisite experience. But some of us yearn to do something else, or some of us are not fit for that big box work in the hospital. And some of us, because of our unique skill set, need something that's totally revolutionary.
Absolutely. Right? And there's also communities out there in need of the services that we have to offer. But because we're not out there, no one's benefiting from it.
Yeah, agreed. The topic, incidentally, of the research topic, and I threw it out there because, you know, the advisors come up with a topic and students sign up the thing they'd like to work on. And you will love my topic that the students refined. It is, how do occupational therapy practitioners, how are they coping during the COVID-19 pandemic? Is that
great question?
Is that a great question or what?
That's a great question.
And they found in their literature search that they reported on yesterday that many other disciplines, nursing, physical medicine and rehab, all that, very worthy, that's been studied. But occupational therapy populations, clinician populations haven't been studied yet.
Yes.
Guess what? They're about to set the world on fire.
All right. Well, I can't wait to listen and to hear more about the study. In my experience, just over the past year of doing this podcast, if you ask me that question, right, how have I observed OTs to have, you know, really dealt with COVID as clinicians?
Yeah.
A lot of OTs I know have pivoted. They've pivoted their careers. They've, you know, again, moved or embarked into non-traditional occupational therapy practice areas during this time.
Yeah, and they rebrand themselves as something else, and they don't call it skilled OT. And this is something, may I offer much kudos to one of the great leaders of our profession, Mary Everett, right? She still does consulting in the San Diego area. She's a resident of the San Diego area, and she does workshops and does conference sessions on, well, how can we rebrand ourselves? Because we can't be so reliant on physicians, with all due respect to our referral sources and physicians, for skilled OT. We need to come out with a very revolutionary new way of getting paid, of getting compensated, of getting reimbursed, so that we're getting out of that medical model. As medical a foundation as we are, and we have to break that envelope, push that envelope.
Yeah. And that will always be there. It's not that that's going to go away, right?
Yeah.
And also, you know, part of what it's for me, it's if you're beating your head against the same wall, right? And it's the same result. Why are you going to keep beating your head in the same wall? That's so not OT. We need to modify. We need to adapt and try other ways, try other environments, right? And then see if, you know, we feel more effective, or we are more effective, or we're able to affect more people, more communities in that sense. So I love the trajectory that our profession is going, because those traditional sites will always be there, and there will always be room for that. And like you said, that's all great foundational knowledge, right? I also had a love for mental health, and always talk about how when I got out of school, because we weren't really encouraged to go out there into the community, I found myself a mental health job in the hospital, right?
Yeah,
so very medical model job in psychiatric rehab, actually, which was great foundation for all of my community-based work later on. But the options were so much less, and definitely not as colorful as it looks today. So
and historically, and even now, you don't get paid as much, you know. So that's something that your listeners would appreciate, you know, because that's what led to a lot of burnout. And I was one of many thousands of OTRs who had the mental health background in the 90s and the 2000s. I left to work in long-term acute care in the early 2000s, maybe 2004.
Mm-hmm.
I started then, and I totally left it later in that year.
Yes.
And when that's all you do, and the reimbursement isn't that great, and you notice what you're worth in other practice settings, you owe it to yourself to take a look, right? Not that I'm a money grubber, and I'm wanting to grab it with both fists and all of that, but you have to live too. You have to take your mortgage to your obligations.
Yes. And if you are not happy, right, these are worthy avenues to explore. If you're happy, fine. Stay doing what you're doing. But if there's a part of you that's uncomfortable or just want to do something else or try something even different on the side, right? We're talking about that too, how you don't have to quit your full-time gig. You can just start doing something different or something else on the side to complement what you're already doing. So so many different options.
Yeah. And one that I've heard of was from an ergonomic specialist, and she has her own consulting practice because for years she was in the chief ergonomist. Many people locally know of her. Her first name, Barbara Phillips, right? She goes by Barb. I've seen her present at conferences and she's amazing and she's so humble. And she talks about how she branched out on her own because she knew with the economic crunch hitting a lot of government budgets, right? She knew that her days were numbered in LA County being the chief ergonomist, right? So she started her own consulting practice and it's grown by leaps and bounds. Yes. I saw her present on that and I thought, this is fantastic. So
is she an OT?
Yeah, she's an OT. Okay. And she and she got her clinical doctorate, I suspect, after she left City and County of LA. Because if you're going to be tooting your own horn, so to speak, and in your own practice of your own creation, that's another thing. I'm beyond getting the OGD because I'm older. And by the time I've spent the funds to get it, I'm not going to have a lot of any working years left, right? So
To earn it back.
And your audience members need to know that too, because if they have a passion to earn a specialized degree, whether it's the clinical doctorate or a doctorate in some other pursuit, the education, the EDD, right? Or the PhD, the doctorate in philosophy, do it. And it's really neat hearing about some OTs, and I've seen them in conference presentations. They have their OTR, OTD degree, and they have their JD. They went to law school.
Yeah.
How cool a combination is that?
Yes, really is. But also important to highlight that you don't need all of those degrees, right?
True. I have, what you do.
I've interviewed OTAs on this platform who have branched out into entrepreneurial ventures on their own, right? Not requiring an OTD. Again, it's the OT lens that we're talking about and how you're seeing the big picture, right? Yeah. So I don't want to discourage anybody. These are all wonderful things because it'll basically make you eligible for other things that you may not be eligible for.
Right. But don't let that be, you know, the golden ring where you're a failure if you're not trying. Because I tell students all the time, many of you are going to be perfectly happy being seasoned CODAs without pursuing advanced education.
Yes.
Others of you may feel passionate about pursuing it further. It depends on what lens you're looking through, what vision you have for yourself.
Yeah.
And in some industries, you need to have advanced education. In others, you don't. In still others, you just need to know people.
Yes.
You know, and provided you know the right people, my God, you can go create many interesting places.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, but Frances, thank you so very much for sharing all of your wisdom, for sharing about your various roles and speaking to us in detail about all of them. There's a lot that goes into teaching. It's not just, you know, standing in front of a classroom, right?
No, and I didn't even mention smart board technology and all of this. It's like for those people who embrace technology, they'll make the adjustment fine. For those who are reluctant, and there are parts of me that still can't handle some of these smart board functions, I can be a dinosaur too. But you know what? Live and learn.
Yes.
Yeah. But thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And that wraps up another inspiring episode of the Uncommon OT series. Connect with me at www.transitionsot.com. And don't forget to sign up to be part of the Transitions OT community. By doing so, you'll receive my latest compiled list of Uncommon OT practice settings, the latest news on mentoring offerings, Uncommon OT live events, non-traditional OT resources, and more. You may also follow me on my social media pages on Instagram and LinkedIn. And if you love this episode, head on over to Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, and Google Podcasts to follow, rate, and leave a review. I also ask you to consider pledging your support to my passion podcast project by being a patron on Patreon. It is very much appreciated. Sending big OT love. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.